And so while an increasing number of young people identify themselves now as pro-life, fewer are convinced that marriage is a unique relationship of committed love between one man and one woman, oriented toward the good of the spouses and the procreation and education of children. Rather, they see the definition of marriage simply as a matter of equality. If two people of the same sex love each other enough to commit to each other, so the reasoning goes, why shouldn't they be allowed to marry? And why shouldn't they enjoy the benefits accorded to all married couples? It's a matter of fairness and civil rights, a matter of overcoming unjust discrimination, or so it goes. Before assigning reasons for this state of affairs, let's reflect on what it means to redefine marriage. For thousands of years, people of diverse cultures and religions have regarded marriage as a complementary relationship of love between one man and one woman, pledged to permanence, fidelity, and openness to the gift of new life. Marriage was regarded as an all-encompassing relationship, not merely an emotional union, and not merely a bodily union, but indeed a union of mind, heart, soul, and body. A love so complete that by its very nature, it is capable of bringing forth new life into the world. A love so complete that it leads to the establishment of stable homes, where children can grow and flourish toward maturity. It was further thought that the state had a legitimate interest in this unique relationship called marriage and family, because it is from loving parents and stable homes that well-adjusted, educated, skilled, and virtuous citizens would come. Because of its immense contribution to the common good, the state afforded marriage special protections and benefits. Yet there's more. Even though marriage was valued because of its benefits to society, it was also regarded as an inherently valuable state of life, not merely a way of securing good outcomes. Marriage was thought to have intrinsic value because the good of procreating human life in a relationship of committed, permanent, and faithful love was thought to be inherently valuable. In the main, this view of marriage is not particularly religious. It is not expressive of any particular theology, but rather was broadly shared in Western culture and many other cultures as well. It is found in one form or another in the writings of philosophers like Aristotle or Socrates, and in many faiths, biblical and non-biblical. Nor did this understanding of marriage emerge out of a desire to discriminate against any group or class of persons, such as those with the same-sex attraction. Rather, this view or understanding of marriage made sense to a very, very wide swath of people, representing many races and cultures and epochs. In a word, this understanding of marriage has something to do with natural law, that law written on our human hearts, to which St. Paul makes reference. This view represents fundamental human goods toward which the human will and intellect tends, even if the human spirit has been weakened and darkened by sin. There is another reason why marriage was thought to be unique and to have intrinsic value. This reason has to do with the inbuilt link between the human person and the human body. Growing up, we were taught at home and at school to respect our bodies, not just because they are an ingenious compilation of cells, which when combined properly and functioning normally, can do wonderful things. Rather, we were taught that our body is part of our personhood. Respect for one's body is part of respecting one's person. The body was seen as an integral part of one's personhood, with inbuilt meaning and inbuilt dignity. This, too, seems to have changed, or so many observers seem to think. Now the body is regarded less as an integral part of one's personhood and more the instrument of one's will. What's more, nowadays, the relationship between will and intellect is sometimes understood differently than was previously the case. If before reason was thought to guide the will in choosing the good, today reason is seen more as the servant of the will, guiding the will to find ways to obtain and enjoy what it wants. The interior of the person is seen less as a spiritual core of contemplation and virtue, and more as a bundle of wants and needs and desires, often styled as rights. Rights which have little to do with the fundamental freedoms of the human person. If the intellect is the servant of the will, the body is the instrument of the will, the means by which the will's desires are fulfilled. The body's value lies in its instrumentality. To be sure, in this view of things, the body should be taken care of as if it were a very fine instrument, but only an instrument, and not a sign or a symbol of anything deeper. The foregoing, of course, is a Cliff's Notes version of those philosophical problems that Blessed John Paul II addressed in his Theology of the Body. I mention these philosophical problems because they have a lot to do with the redefinition of marriage that is now underway in much of the world. In 1968, when Pope Paul VI issued his encyclical Humanae Vitae, it was widely rejected by many, both within the church and the wider culture. A principal critique focused on the encyclical's supposed physicalism or biologism, that is to say, its analysis of the inbuilt meaning of conjugal love in its physical dimensions. This critique claims that the encyclical absolutized the physical dimension of the act and identified it with the truly human and moral aspect of the act. What has come to pass, however, is that the human and moral aspect of the conjugal act has been very nearly divorced from its physical dimension. The body is merely an instrument to be used as a person wishes, even sexually, so long as everyone consents and is of age and no one gets hurt. It is easy to see how this view of the human body opens the door not only for same-sex marriage, but for many other types of sexual arrangements. It's not surprising as well that many who dissented from Humanae Vitae now dissent from the church's teaching on marriage as between one man and one woman. Ideas, of course, have consequences, and this set of ideas is no exception. While the fundamental notion of marriage has been under assault philosophically, the institution of marriage and family have been under assault in popular culture through contraception, abortion, no-fault divorce, through government overreach, and unrelentingly negative portrayals of marriage and family in the media and in popular entertainment. The onus for this bundle of cultural problems does not rest with any one particular group of people. It is a responsibility we all share. But this bundle, if I could describe it that way, has helped prepare the ground for a wholesale redefinition of marriage now underway. A redefinition which I would submit could lead to the abolition of marriage. How this is so will become apparent as we look at how marriage is being redefined. It is increasingly apparent that the redefinition of marriage means more than merely expanding who might be eligible to enter into it. It's more than saying, whereas formerly only two members of the opposite sex could marry, now two members of the same sex can marry. Rather, redefining marriage means a profound change in what society understands marriage to be. If before it was widely regarded as the bodily union of man and woman ordered to new life, with at least some expectation of permanence and fidelity, now marriage is increasingly understood as a legally sanctioned emotional bond, more or less permanent, more or less exclusive between consenting adults. We can readily see that this notion of marriage jettisons what in fact is unique to marriage as the one flesh union of a man and a woman ordered to new life, ordered toward permanence, fidelity, and stable family life. If marriage really is a mere emotional bond among consenting adults who want to have their relationship legally formalized, a relationship with no inherent link to the procreation of children, some would say that there is no reason to limit it only to two individuals. And let's not lose sight of this. Those who hold for same-sex monogamy are regarded in some quarters today as regressive. In the view of some contemporary thinkers, the very institution of marriage, however it is conceived of, is repressive and unjust. There is advocacy for reorganizing human relationships in ways other than marriage, and in thinking of families as almost anything other than mom, dad, and the kids. Once marriage has been loosened from its conjugal moorings, It is on the path to extinction. It is on the path to being replaced entirely. The redefinition of marriage could indeed lead to its abolition as a state of life worthy of special recognition and protection, both in law and in culture. In the minds of many, however, redefining marriage seems harmless. As noted earlier, many see it as a matter of equality and fairness, simply expanding the universe of those eligible to marry. And they see it as having no religious liberty implications. After all, the government never tires of telling religious folks that no minister with conscientious objections will ever be forced by law to preside over a so-called same-sex marriage. This is said to be sufficient to protect religious liberty. I note in passing that some conscientious justices of the peace and notaries are not so lucky. In some states where same-sex marriage is legal, a number of these individuals were told either to conform to the law or to resign. On a few occasions, I've testified before congressional committees with regard to challenges to religious liberty in the United States, especially with regard to the HHS mandate. During those sessions, I was questioned also about same-sex marriage. The premise of the questions of at least some of the members was that DOMA is comparable to Jim Crow laws, and that those who hold on to the traditional notion of marriage are somehow bigoted, a view which, as we have seen, was echoed in Justice Kennedy's flawed majority opinion on DOMA. I take this view to be a mainspring of all the other religious liberty problems which the broad legalization of same-sex marriage will produce. What the Church teaches regarding marriage and sexuality will be regarded not just as old-fashioned or irrelevant, but rather as a form of hate speech which deserves to be punished. Professor Eugene Volich of UCLA, a supporter of same-sex marriage, says that after the gay rights movement ends repressive laws against gays and enacts laws securing equal treatment, its next goal, and I quote, has to do with delegitimizing and legally punishing private behavior that discriminates against or condemns homosexuals. The Church's teaching itself clearly and wholly condemns discriminating against and condemning people with a homosexual inclination. But it also strongly upholds the truth about human sexuality and marriage. Indeed, the Catechism of the Catholic Church speaks of the respect, compassion, and sensitivity that we should have toward all, including those of a homosexual inclination, adding that every sign of unjust discrimination in their regard must be avoided. But not content with that, Professor Volich and many like him seek to delegitimize those parts of the Church's teaching that he finds to be discriminatory. And this is not imaginary. Not long ago, efforts were made to bar a Catholic campus chaplain in Washington, D.C., from a university campus because in a Catholic parish church where university students gather for Mass, he defended marriage as between one man and one woman. There are other efforts to chill the conversation about marriage and sexuality, such as local and state anti-discrimination laws. On the surface, it might appear that such laws are in accord with Catholic teaching on respecting the rights and dignity of persons that experience same-sex attraction. Yet if one looks a little bit deeper, it becomes apparent that such laws, which usually include no religious liberty protections, could be used to put a damper on the free expression of the Church's teaching on marriage in the public square, and force the Church to employ and provide benefits for those involved in